Okay, we're beginning at the bottom of Tzadik Ted Amud Bet. We did the Mishnah yesterday, but we'll just review it quickly, which is Shuma Dayanim. When it comes to the assessment of the Dayanim, Shepichtu Shtut or Sifu Shtut, where they underestimated or overestimated by a six, Michran Batel. Then we annul the transaction because there's a mispricing of the properties or the items that they are selling over here. There's a lot of discussion amongst the Rishonim as to what exactly is the case that is being discussed in the Mishnah over here. Because we know in certain instances, the Dayanim get indemnified. We know in other cases with regards to Karkaot, where there is no Ona'ah. If Ona'ah is only at 50%, according to Balei HaTosfot, according to some others, there is no Ona'ah at all by Karkaot. So what exactly is the situation that we're discussing in the Mishnah by which the transaction would be annulled in these instances? So the summary Shonim would discuss the fact that it is a case of metaltolin. So that's why we're dealing with the shtut and not the shtut. Others discuss exactly what is the scenario here in the Mishnah. Is this not a case where they are doing it on behalf of a party who is a willing party, but rather against the will of the party? So for instance, they're going into a debtor's property and selling it off on behalf of the creditors. They're taking money from his own oath when the husband's still around. There, when they're doing against their will, that's where we would invoke this Mishnah. On the other hand, where they're acting on behalf of the parties willingly, meaning the parties want them involved in the process, maybe over there they would not be held accountable, held to this standard. So the Rishonim are dealing with exactly what is the scenario here, because we know that in many instances, we find that Beit Din is indemnified, or when they're acting on behalf of a party, we assume that they're doing the right thing, and then we don't reverse the transaction. B'Shimon Gamliel Omer, Michran Kayam. B'Shimon Gamliel, on the other hand, says that the transaction stays, because Imkein Makoach Beit Din Yofeh. Then what's the whole point of going to Beit Din? How is Beit Din better than any other process or vehicle for selling if you're going to reverse what Beit Din does anyway? So what's the benefit of going to Beit Din rather than selling it on your own or doing another way? Because Beit Din is not protected from the sale being locked in place. Aval imasui geret bikoret. On the other hand, if they have this letter of checking, which is Rashi explains now, which is hachraza, they did it through a public auction, that people checked it out and they saw the property, then imseo iger bikoret b'nehem afilu mechru shaveh maneh b'matayim or shaveh matayim b'maneh michran kayam. That point, if they sold something that's worth 100 for 200 or 200 for 100, then the sale stands because they did it with the public auction. And what else could they have done? Once you've opened it up to price discovery through a public auction, you can't blame Beit Din for not garnering a better price or a different price. That was the market value at the time that they did it. That's what they garnered through the auction. And we can't say to them, oh, you did the wrong thing or you didn't do that. So if they follow the protocols or if they go through the processes that are done by Beit Din, then we have to assume that they garnered the right price, and we're not going to hold them accountable for those fluctuations in the price. So now, in general, the Rabbeinu Tam says that the Gemara uses the term igeret versus shtar in different situations. It says that they use the term shtar for a declaration of Beit Din or determination of Sak Beit Din. Igeret is when one Beit Din sends it to another Beit Din, instructing them or telling them what they did. So that's generally what the Rabbeinu Tam, how he distinguishes between the Lashon of Igeret and the Lashon of Shtar. What Tosafot points out is that the Rabbeinu Tam's distinction doesn't really hold in our Mishnah, because over here the Igeret Bikoret is not talking about where they're sending it to another Beit Din. Clearly it's talking about this Beit Din itself, that they are doing this in a public auction. You could argue that they sent this out to start the auction or to create the auction, and maybe that would support the Rabbeinu Tam. But over here, the Lashon of Igeret does not necessarily fit that distinction that the Rabbeinu Tam sets. So now the Gemara says, Ibailuhu, Shliach Keman. Who is a Shliach like? When you set up an agent, what is the status of this agent? Rav Amar Rav Nachman, Shliach Kedayanim. The Shliach has the same status as the Dayan. Rav Shmor Bar Bisna Amar Rav Nachman Kealmana. That is a din like Almana. Now there are a number of pieces to the puzzle here. The first one is, what type of Shliach are we speaking about? Rashi says it's a shliach da'alma. This is a regular shliach that makes a mistake. So any agent that's set up by an individual, what is the status of that shliach when he makes a mistake? And we'll discuss what the issues are. Many of the Rishonim believe that the shliach over here might possibly be a shliach beitin. that it's a shliach appointed by Beit Din to act on behalf of Beit Din. So it wouldn't be a shliach d'alma, but here we're talking specifically about a shliach of Beit Din. Now, we have the next piece, which is, what is his status? As far as the almanah is concerned, the previous Mishnah told us that when the almanah makes any mistake, we annul the transaction. As soon as she makes even a dinar's worth of a mistake, the transaction is annulled, and we have to start over again. So that's the question. Is this shliach like an almanah, which is that we reverse it automatically? Or is the shliach a dayanim? The dayanim over here, which is shepichtu shtut, ohu sifu shtut, michran batel. They have a certain amount of leeway in terms of the valuation. What is the status of a shliach? Is he viewed like the dayanim, where he has some leeway? Or is he viewed like the almanah, where he has no room at all? Now, the Gemara explains why. Rav amar rach nachman shliach ke dayanim, that he has some leeway. My dayanim lav ledidhu. Ashliach nami lav ledidei. Lafuki almanah did ledida. So over here, the difference being is whether you have an invested interest in the sale. When it comes to Beit Din has no vested interest in the sale. They're selling on behalf of other parties. They will not garner anything from the sale. The same is true here with the shliach. The shliach is an independent party. So just like the dayanim are independent parties, so too is the shliach an independent party over here. As opposed to the almanah, who is selling the property for her own benefit. I mean, she might be helping the Yatomim as well, but she definitely is selling it, or she's empowered to sell it, for her mizonot, for her ketubah. These are items that she will garner the proceeds of the sale. So there she is a nogea badavar. So maybe that would be the din of shliach, and that's what Rav Ibn Nachman says, the shliach is more like a dayan, in the sense that he's an independent party. On the other hand, Rav Shmuel bar Bistam, Rav Nachman, ki almanah. More like the almanah. Ma almanah yechida. Just like an almanah acts on her own, af shliach yechid. So too, the shliach is acting on his own. Lafuke Beit Din derabim ninhu. Versus a Beit Din, which are multiple parties here. So at least then you have some back and forth, you have some balances and checks, because you have three people looking at this, not simply one person that's looking at it. The hilchata, shliach ki almanah. The halacha is that the shliach has the same din as an almanah, which means that any mistake will be reversed. He doesn't get that same benefit of being a dayan, where you have some leeway in the mistake that is made. All right, so Tosafot over here discusses an issue that presents a problem, which is that the shliach that we're speaking about over here seems to contradict what Rav Nachman just said before. We had in the Gemara before that Rav Nachman says that if a shliach makes a mistake, he can say to him, the sender of the shliach, or the empowerer of the shliach, can say, L'tikunei shadartich, lo la'avuti. I sent you to do something good for me, not something bad. Implying that any small mistake, we would unravel the transaction, or annul the transaction because of that mistake. Right, assuming that it's to his detriment. But over here, Rav Nachman is saying the shliach has a din like a dayan. And over there, he says that a shliach has a din like the almanah, basically. So how do we reconcile that? In addition to that, there's a statement of Rava in the beginning of Kiddushin that also says something similar. L'tkunei shadartich velo le'avuti. I sent you for my benefit and not for my detriment. And so Rava himself also seems to think that a shliach has the same status as an almanah. So if I take both Rava and Rav Nachman, who both seemingly say that a shliach is like almanah, then all of a sudden over here they say shliach kedayan. So how do I reconcile between those two different things? So now the Rabbeinu Shmuel, that's the Rashbam, says that Hatam Rava the feast varato kamar, aval Rav Nachman lo svirle. So over there, Rava is speaking in his own name, and Rav Nachman doesn't hold of that. So that's how he reconciles between the Gemara and Kiddushin of Rava versus over here. So he says there Rava was speaking on his own behalf, and over here Rav Nachman is speaking, and Rav Nachman doesn't hold of Rava. The Tosafot read says it just in the opposite direction. Hacha amar mishum Rav Nachman rabbe. Over here, Rava is saying it in the name of Rav Nachman. Ba'atam amar didei. And over there, Rava is saying it in his own name. So Rava believes that based on the conclusion of our Gemara. Because our Gemara says, shliach ki almanah. So Rava over there is speaking based on the conclusion of the Gemara. Over here, he's just bringing in what his Rebbe Rav Nachman had suggested. So that's one way to reconcile it. The Rabbeinu Tam reconciles by saying here, Hacha mayri b'shliach didayanim, da'alim kocho tvei, u'michro kayam ad shtut. Rabbeinu Tam solves the problem by what we just said before. He disagrees with Rashi that the shliach we're speaking about here is any shliach, Here he says it's particularly a shliach beitin, who has a higher standing than a normal shliach. And so because of that, the din will be different. The shliach of beitin will have a din like the dayanim. A regular shliach will have a din like an amanah. So that's the way the Rabbeinu Tam reconciles it. But nearly, and then we have the last, the Tosfot himself, who suggests, the hachari afilu b'shliach d'alma. I'll agree with Rashi that the shliach is any type of shliach over here. Ule'el damar Rav Nachman. And what Rav Nachman said before, that when it comes to a shliach, you're allowed to null the transaction because you can say to him, I sent you to do my bidding, not to do something to my detriment. That's a case. B'yeter mishtut. That's more than a sixth. Meaning that when he said that you can unwind it before, that wasn't any small infraction. That means that it has to be at least of a value where we normally retract a sale, and that's 1/6. So over there, you would say, bit lo kayam. So you can do one of two things. You can either take the case over there and say that it is governed by what we see over here, or you can say that, take the case over there and say that what we have over here is governed by that case. So that's exactly what Rabbeinu Tam says, that our case over here is governed by what's over there. Therefore, this case has to be talking about a different case. So it's a shliach beitin. The Tosafot says the other way around. The case over there is governed by what we have over here. And therefore, it means that the shtut is what he meant by the mistake in that previous Gemara. And so that it's only governed by a shtut. What Rav Nachman says over here, and the Tosafot concludes, that shliach dayanim, hainu linyan ha de mekach kayam. That means that the transaction stands, is not annulled. Avalo ona tzarich miyol achzir. He still has to return the excess. Meaning that even though we're going to say here that the transaction stands, that doesn't mean you get to keep the excess. You have to return the excess like any other case of ona'a. V'cheina dayanim. Ten koach beitin yafeh klal tfeimi b'shaliach ta'alma. Because the strength of beitin is not greater than a regular shaliach. And therefore, in the cases where shtut is an issue, the only question we're discussing over here is whether the transaction stays intact. So is it annulled or stay intact? If it stays intact, he still has to return the excess, or they have to reverse the excess. We'll just leave the transaction intact with the reversal of the excess piece that's there. The Tosafot read goes on to explain that the Rav Haigon thinks that when we say a shliach is ka'almanah, not only is a shliach ka'almanah in the sense that if he makes a mistake, he's like an almanah and we reverse it, but also the need for shlosha hejotot, that you need an assessment by an independent body of three hejotot. Even though you have to take it to Beit Din in order to sell it, you still have to do it in front of three hejotot. He says the same thing applies to a shliach. When we say shliach almanah, the Tosafot read rejects that and he says that's not the case. An almanah is different than a shliach. Again, the shliach is either appointed by the Beit Din or he's acting as an agent, and therefore he won't need to get a shlosha hejotot. The almanah is acting on her own behalf, will require an outside assessment. And therefore he rejects the Rahai's conclusion and says shliach almanah is only about making mistakes, not about the assessment by an independent party. Okay, the Gemara says, Mishnah mi'adetnan, how's this different than the Mishnah in Truma? Homer l'shlucho, tzei vitrom, go ahead and take off Truma. Toreim kedat balabayit. He has to take off based on what he knows the balabayit would take off. Vimeinu yodea dato sho balabayit. If he doesn't know what the balabayit normally takes off from his Truma, toreim bebenonit, echad mi'chamishim. He takes off what is considered to be a middle of the road percentage, which is 1/50th or 2%. When it comes to truma, as we discussed yesterday, chita achat poteret et akri, that even one kernel takes care of truma, but the Rabbanan set up that there are different levels of giving truma, and that is 1/40th, 1/50th, and 1/60th. Someone who's generous gives 1/40th. Some normal people, benonit, give 1/50th, 2%, and those that are a little more miserly give 1/60th. So over here they say, go in the middle of the road and give 1/50th. Picheta sara, osifa sara, trumato truma. But if he went up a tenth or down a tenth, not 10%, but rather 1/40th through 1/60th, anything in that range, his truma is a good truma. If he's outside of that range, then the truma is batel, because he didn't act within the context of what we consider to be normal giving of truma. But what you see here is that we give him latitude within the context. And so that would answer your question from before, that when a shliach makes a mistake or makes a mistake, we give them leeway or latitude based on the context. So here, in Truma, you see that the context is 1/40th to 1/60th. And over here, a shtot or whatever the normal context should be, why don't we grant that latitude to the shliach? Just like he has that latitude by the Truma, we should say the same thing by the regards to assessments. And Tosafot says that, just like over there, we say, when the Balabait empowered the Shliach, he basically relied on the Shliach. And he can't come back and say, listen, I didn't mean that, because if he did mean that, then he should have said it explicitly. The fact that he didn't define what he wanted, then the Shliach is empowered to work within the context of the normal framework or boundaries of 140th to 160th. So too over here. If he empowered him and didn't tell him something specifically, then he should be also empowered to work within the normal context. So why are we locking the Shliach down here? To even the slightest mistake, it gets reversed, whereas in Truma, we're giving him latitude. So over there, because there is a person who gives 160th, and there is a person who gives 140th. Over there, he'll say to him, that's what I assessed you to be. I assumed that you were a generous guy. I assumed that you were a little more tight-fisted. Over here, it's a mistake. He can't claim, I thought you wanted me to make a mistake. I thought you would be generous in the sale or miserly in the sale. That's not a determination that makes sense in this context. He can say to him, listen, you shouldn't have made a mistake. It's one thing where, by Truma, he can say, I'm in with the normal bounds of what people can assume. And my mistake was not a mistake in the actual separation of the Truma, but rather how I assessed what type of person you are, how generous or how miserly you are. And that is something that he was empowered to do, in sense, make a mistake about. But in terms of making a mistake in the valuation, that the Baal HaBayit doesn't empower him to make a mistake in the valuation, therefore the context is not same. You can't compare the two. I mean, the flexibility within Truma is because there is real flexibility there. Within the Shtut, that is not a context. That's just saying, look, we don't want to have every transaction be held to a penny. So therefore we give some latitude in mistakes within transactions. But that assumes that people are making somewhat of a mistake. When you're an agent, you're not empowered to make mistakes on behalf of the seller. And therefore, you lose your agency when you start making those mistakes. Amar Ravuna Bar Chanina. Amar Rav Nachman. Halocha kedivrei chachamim. The halocha in our Mishnah is like the chachamim. Meaning the Tana Kama versus Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. The late later Rav Nachman, makoech beitin yaveh. Doesn't Rav Nachman hold of this principle? That once Beit Din takes an action, we want to uphold the action for the integrity of Beit Din. I would say for both reasons, meaning that for the reason that what's the purpose of going to Beit Din if the Beit Din's position doesn't hold. But number two is, you're also undermining the power of Beit Din, undermining the integrity of Beit Din if we unwind transactions of Beit Din, because then it's going to cast aspersions on the actions of Beit Din. So from both perspectives, Makoch Beit Din Yafeh would instruct us to keep the transaction intact. So how can we hear that Rav Nachman is paskening like the Tana Kama and not taking up what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says here, that Makoch Beit Din Yafeh? V'amar Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel, Yitomim Shebo'u Lachlok B'Nichse Avien. Yitomim that are coming to divide up the estate of their father. Beit Din Mamidin Lahem Apotropos. Beit Din appoints for them an executor. U'borin Lahem Chelk Yafeh. And they choose for them a good piece. Now the problem here is it switches from singular into the plural. It says that they are mamidim lahen apotropus, which would be the singular, one executor. But then it says borin in plural. You can see already what Rashi says about that. Rashi says, l'kol echad ve'echad min haktanim. They put together an executor or a guardian for each one of the yitomim. And then those guardians fight it out on behalf of the yitomim. There's not a single executor of the estate that works on behalf of all the yitomim. There is an executor for each one of the yitomim. And that's what it means, borurin. That's how Rashi differentiates. There are others who suggest that mamidin lahen apitropus is Beit Din puts one executor. Uborurin, borurin is Beit Din. Beit Din gets the executor to do it on their behalf. And that's what the borurin is here. It's the borurin is because he's the shliach of Beit Din. Therefore, he picks for all of them based on Beit Din, and that's what the borurin is over here. It's really not that each one gets an executor, but there's a singular executor for the estate. The Rambam here says that is only true when there are gdolim as well, which is that there are gdolim in the estate who want to divide the estate. So therefore, we have to appoint executors on behalf of the tomim to be their representatives in the split. But if they're all ktanim, there's no reason to put in executors because the Ketanim themselves are not going to demand to split it. Although from Tosafot and from Rashi over here, it seems that even if they're all Ketanim, we would divide it up and we would appoint executors to help them out in the division. So now, the question is how you divide it. Rashi seemingly says that they fight it out, that the Apitropsim, each one of them fights on behalf of their Yatom to get the best situation. Tosafot over here brings a possibility of Goral, that they do it through a lottery. In that they subdivide the property into sections, and then they do a lottery for who gets which part of that. Now that has a number of different layers to it. One is, does a goral work in this case? Are you allowed to use a goral in this case and not go by fixed assessments of the property and then have the executors work on their behalf? That's number one. Number two is, there's a principle, which we have, anytime you have partners that are dividing the property, you usually have what you call a put call option, which is that the individual can split the property and then say to him, either you buy it or you sell it to me. When they have options like that, can that be done in this instance as well? What happens if they come up with two pieces of property and they're trying to subdivide, they're arguing over value? So they say, okay, you'll split it and then I'll decide whether you buy from me or I buy it from you. So the question of how to deal with it, that question also arises over here. Is to what point are the executors empowered to act in this way? And to what extent do the Yitomim have the right to reverse it? We're going to see in a second they have a right to question what the executors did. How far does that questioning go? So over here, the Gemara says, Higdilu yocholim limchot. When they get older, they're allowed to reject what was done on their behalf. But Rav Menachem didei amar, Higdilu ein yocholim limchot. When they come of age, they're not allowed to reject what was done. Im kein makoach beitin yofeh. So he invokes this principle, if they're able to reject what was done on their behalf, then you basically undermine anything that Beit Din does. So again, the same problems. You're questioning the integrity of the Beit Din. Plus, what's the point of going to Beit Din if it can be reversed anyway? Lo kasha. It's not a problem. Over there in our Mishnah, it's a case where they made a mistake. Over there, we do not invoke the principle of Makoach Beit Din Yafeh. They don't get that power when they're making a mistake. Ha, delo tau. In our case of here, it's a case where they didn't make a mistake. So now the Gemara asks, idulo tau. If they didn't make a mistake, then why are the Tomim later on coming and questioning how the division was done if there was no mistake made over here? What type of claim do they have over here? The Gemara says, biruchot. That they did it based on the location of the property that they were granted. So the Tomim say, listen, I own property on the east side of this, and you granted me a piece on the west side, so now I don't have contiguous property. So I want to reject it based on that, because I would have much preferred the property on the eastern side, maybe even though it's maybe slightly lower quality, or it's a smaller piece, because then at least my properties would be adjacent. So there's a value to that. So that's what they can reject, or that's what we thought they possibly could reject over here, is the fact that it's ruchot. From that, that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says, Haya Rabbi Ragilda Fresh Minakad Lashon Borim Alma Below Goral Airi. It's pretty clear here that we're not talking about a goral. Because how could you reject which side the property came out on if you're using something as objective as a lottery? In a lottery, you don't get to pick which side of the property that you get. You simply get whatever comes out on the lot. So how can you come back later and say, I wanted the property on the eastern side, not the western side, if the whole thing was done through a lottery anyway? But anyway, so that's, he uses that as a proof based on our Gemara that they clearly were not using a lottery over here. But he says, V'lo nihiro l'Rabbeinu Tam. L'Rabbeinu Tam disagrees. So you have here within the Tosafot an argument as to whether the Borurin over here means literally that they subdivide it and that they fight over it on behalf of the Yitomim, or are we invoking a Goral over here and trying to fit that into the Gemara? Again, these are different methodologies in Machloket and the Rishonim as how exactly these Apitropsim, these executors, act on behalf of the Yitomim. Ki'at Rav Dimi, Amar Maaseh. There was a case, Vasar Rabbi Kedivrei Chachamim. And Rabbi Paskin like the Chachamim, similar to the way that we just said, Aloha is like the Chachamim in our Mishnah. Amar Lefanav, Prata, Beno, Shel Rabbi Elazar, Ben Prata, Ben Beno, Shel Rabbi Prata Agadol. So now, if you were just to read this simply, you would read this as, Prata is the son of Rabbi Elazar, whose father was Prata, so he was named after his grandfather Prata, which would make a lot of sense. And his grandfather Prata was the grandson of the great Prata. So there you have it. three times that you have the name Prata. There's Prata Gadol. His grandson is Prata. And the one who's speaking to us now is the grandson of the grandson of that Rabbi Prata Gadol. So you have basically five generations that are listed over here. And this is the fifth generation of this Prata because his grandfather and his great-great-grandfather were Prata. Tosafot interprets it differently. If you look in Tosafot, Tosafot says, Perish tu ben benosh Rabbi Prata Gadol. I mean that it's defining for us this Prata, who's the son of Rabbi Elazar ben Prata, he is the grandson of Prata Gadol. That means that his grandfather was Prata Gadol. So only have three generations mentioned here, not five generations mentioned over here. What did he say to Rabbi? Imkei makoech ba'atin yofeh. He basically invokes the principle of Shimon ben Gamliel against Rabbi. Vechzir Rabbi et amaseh. And Rabbi reversed the psak over here. So he had paskin like the Chachamim of our Mishnah, and he reverses it based on this claim of Prato that basically accords with what Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel says in the Mishnah. Rav Dimi Matni Hochi. That's the version of the story according to Rav Dimi. Rav Safra Matni Hochi. But here's the version of the story according to Rav Safra. Maaseh ubikesh Rabbi lasot kedibrei Chachamim. Rabbi wanted to act in accordance with the Chachamim of our Mishnah. Amar lafav Prata bno shel Rabbi Elazar ben Prata ben bno shel Rabbi Prata Gadol. Imkein makoach beitin yafeh. Basically invoking the principle of Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, then what's the point of beitin? Lo asa Rabbi et amaseh. And therefore Rabbi did not act on his intuition. So in the first case of Rav Dimi, Rabbi actually paskened alocha and then reversed it. In the second version of the story, in Rav Safa's version in the story, he thought about paskening this way and he caught himself before he paskened this way. So leima ba'aka miflagei. Let us say that this is the argument between the two versions of the story. Mar Savar Tab Dvar Mishnah Chuzer. The first one, Rav Dimi's story, is a case where we assume he made a mistake with the Mishnah, and therefore he has to reverse it. Umar Savar Eino Chuzer. And the other one says, no. If you made a mistake about a Mishnah, Psak stays intact, and you have to repay out of your pocket. You're gonna have to pay the money to repair the situation. Now, the question is, what does it mean, Tab Dvar Mishnah? What does it mean that Rabbi made a mistake with regards to a Mishnah? Over here, he's paskening like the Tanakhama of the Mishnah. So why is it that you call this a Tab Dvar Mishnah? First of all, he's paskening like a Mishnah. Number two, he's paskening like the Rabbim in the Mishnah. That's the Chachamim's position. Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel is a Dat Yachid. So there are two possibilities of how to explain it. One is that we know that the Gemara has a principle in other places that Allah Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel b'matnita. That the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel in the Mishnah. Whenever Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel is in the Mishnah, the halacha is like him. There are a couple of exceptions. But generally, the halacha is like him. So Rabbi forgot that principle. So maybe that's Tav B'Dvar Mishnah, because the halacha is always like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamaliel. You have to assume here that this is not Rabbi's father, Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, but either his great-grandfather or someone who was not directly connected to him, because otherwise he should have known the psak of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamaliel. So that's one possibility as to what Tav B'Dvar Mishnah. Rashi claims over here that Tav B'Dvar Mishnah over here is because Rabbi Shimon ben Gamaliel gave a reason for his position. And his reason makes a lot of sense. So since he gave a reason made a lot of sense, you should have paskin like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamaliel. That principle of the law of Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel may not have been established at the time of Rabbi. That might be in a later Amoraic principle that wasn't around the time of Rabbi. But either way, this is not a classic Tav Dvar Mishnah. Tav Dvar Mishnah is a case where it's an explicit Mishnah and he paskins against it. That's a case where we say Choser. It's so obvious that we don't say that he has to pay out of pocket, but rather we just reverse the whole position because it's so obvious that it's wrong. Or do we say that it's not Choser and you have to pay out of pocket? So that machloket shades the nature of their story. The first one, Rav Dimi's story, says that he made a mistake with the Mishnah and therefore he reversed it. According to Rav Safra, he only wanted to paskin that way, but he didn't actually make the mistake, because had he made the mistake, we wouldn't have reversed it. Where it says, lo, the kuli yama tabit var Mishnah Choser. Everybody agrees, if you make a mistake with regards to a Mishnah, you're Choser. Umar sarve hachi avi maser, umar sarve hachi avi maser. Basically, it's an argument about the facts here. There's no halachic nafkamina between their two positions. It's simply a question about what was the mitziut in the case here. What happened? And they're arguing about what happened. One had the Mesorah of the story this one, and the other one had the Mesorah of the story the other way. Amar of Yosef. Amar lata, dezvinach achrayuta yatme, ubeitin dezavin achrayuta yatme. Again, we saw this back on Daf Tzadi Zayin, which is when the almanah acts on behalf of the estate and sells property, the buyer has recourse against the estate. And the same thing with beitin. When beitin acts on behalf of the yatomim and sells property, The recourse is on the Yitomim themselves. Recourse is not on the Almanah, it's not on the Beit Din, it's on the properties of the Yitomim. Pshita, of course, what else would you think? They're acting on behalf of these parties, why should the recourse be against them? Of course it goes back against the estate for which they are acting. Almanah, lo yitzrichale. For an Almanah, we didn't need this information. It's clear that when the Almanah acts, she's acting on behalf of the Yitomim, and the recourse is against the Yitomim. Yitzrichale the Beit Dinah. We need it for the Beit Din. Mao the Tema, what we'd have thought, called the Zavin me Beit Dina, Adata the Mefik Le Kalahu the Zavin. When they sell on behalf of Beit Din, that is because it's a big public issue. And therefore, we would have thought, you get no recourse. That the thing is sold without Achrayut. Mashman, that you actually do get Achrayut over here. So the way Rashi explains it, and we've discussed this a number of times, is that they didn't have the ability to do title searches in their day. So how do you do a check to make sure that there are no liens on the property? That's why the shtarot were signed, and you need a shtar in order to have a lien on the property. Because anytime a shtar is signed, that's a very public type of thing. You have a deem involved, you have the Beit Din involved, everybody knew about it. So that's how it was made public, that there was a lien on the property, was that there was a written shtar. So publicity was their way of overcoming the problem of title searches. So here the same thing in reverse, which is that here, Beit Din, when they sell it, they put it up to the auction. It's a very, very public type of auction. If there are people who have claims against the property, they would have showed up at this point. They know that Beit Din is selling it, so that if they say we have a claim against the property, they should have showed up already and made their claim. The fact that nobody showed up to make a claim over here tells you that there must be no claims against the property. So maybe when Beit Din sells at this point, they sell without recourse. There's no reason to give recourse, because the assumption is that this is free and clear property. The Kamash one is that we still give him recourse against the Yitomim, despite the fact that it's done through Beit Din, that there is this kal, there is this big commotion or public display of the sale, and therefore any person that would have come should have showed up already at this point in time. That's one way to look at it, as Rashi is suggesting that the buyer basically feels good about it because he sees that nobody stood up to claim the property, even though this was done in a public manner. The other possibility is that when Beit Din acts, they do checks and they make sure that the property is free and clear. And we would assume the fact that Beit Din is auctioning it in such a public manner means that they assume that the property is free and clear. And if that's the case, when the buyer buys it, maybe he thought he was buying it without recourse. Kamashman, that he does get recourse in this case. So the chiddush here is that you get recourse even when Beit Din acts, not anything else. That's the chiddush of that whole statement that we made before about recourse against the Yitomim. Here, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer. Shimon Gamliel says that ma koach Beit Din yafeh. So therefore, we don't reverse the transaction. The Gemara asks a very simple question, v'ad kama. How big a mistake can you make and it still be considered ma koach Beit Din yafeh? And Rav Huna bar Yehuda, Rav Sheshit, ad palga. Up to 50%. Tanya Nami Yochi, we have a braita that supports this. I'm Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Beit Din shemachru shaveh matayim b'maneh. Beit Din that sells something worth 200 for 100, or shaveh maneh b'matayim, or 100 with 200, michran kayam. It stands. No, our mission says by igeret bikoret, it says that. But here they're saying even without igeret bikoret. So here the braita says this in the position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Even without an igeret bikoret, the Beit Din is entitled to make a mistake of that magnitude. Now, 50% over here, when you do a 200 for 100, that is 50%. But if you do a 100 for 200, that's a 100%. But in the Gemara's terminology, 50%, when you raise the number by a percentage, unlike what we do, which is called the 50% milagav, we look at the number, like 100 here, and we say 50% is 50. That would mean that if you add 50% on, it would be 150. For them, they do what's called 50% milabar. 50% milabar means that the new number, the original portion will be 50% of the new number. So over here, the 100, if you make it 200, then the original 100 is 50% of the new number. So for them, that's also considered to be 50%. Even though we would deem that to be a 100% increase, in the Gemara's terminology, that's still called a 50% increase. And that's why it says over here, the mistake is either 200 to 100 or 100 to 200. Both of those in the eyes of the Gemara are considered to be a 50% move. One is a 50% of the gav move when you're doing the reduction, and one is a 50% of the bar move when you're doing the increase upwards. So over there we say it stands. Now, this makes sense, again, within real property. If you're talking about real property, we saw before that there's ein onah, the karkot. So when you say there's ein onah, the karkot, over there you could have such a wide-ranging valuation, quote-unquote, mistake, and we can still consider it to be a valid transaction. So that would work well with Tosafot Shita, which says that there's ein onah karkot up to 50%. So basically what they're doing is bounding it by the bounds of onah, and saying, just like by real property, there's no ona'ah up to the 50%. The same thing will be true with in terms of the mistake of Beit Din. That type of mistake is considered to be within the normal bounds of a mistake. Just like the Tanakhama says, a shtut is the normal bounds of a mistake. Then, over here, we're talking about the bounds of ona'ah karkot. So that could be the possibility, but then it would make it much harder to understand what the Tanakhama's position is, because if you're claiming that it's all based on ona'ah, then why is he using a shtut, which is the ona'ah mental claim, and not property? That does raise a certain amount of questions, but at least we could explain Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's position within that broader context of ona'at karkot. Amar meimar mishmei Rabbi Yosi, beitin shemachru below hachraza, nasu kamisha tal b'dvar mishnah v'chuzrim. A beitin that sells without using a public auction is the equivalent of a beitin that made a mistake about a mishnah and the transaction gets reversed. Where it says, naseh, it's like vadaitau. It's definitely a mistake of a mishnah. It's an explicit mishnah in Arachin. Tetzlan, shuma yitomim shloshim yom. When you want to assess the property of the yitomim, you do a public auction for 30 days. Shuma hekdesh shishim yom. And when Beit Din does it on behalf of hekdesh, then they do it for 60 days. Machrizim baboker ba'erev. We do the public auction, we announce it every morning and every evening. So if you do it for 30 days, they do it every morning and every evening, because that's when the Poalim go out to work, and when they come back, they basically stand out there during rush hour, and their day, the rush hour, is the people walking by. So you have this public announcement, which says that there's going to be an auction for the property, and they do that over 30 days. The other option that the Mishnah has is you do it for 60 days on Monday and Thursdays. So even though that turns out to be less, overall, you know, it turns out to be roughly 18 times, nevertheless, since it's done over a 60-day period, and you do it on Monday, Thursdays, which is the Yom HaShuk, you get much more publicity out of it, so therefore that's sufficient to get the public auction. But in either way, the mission is explicit about how you do it, and that you must do a public auction. So when it says, Ima, if it was just for the Mishnah, I mean, ani milei shliach, that's only when it's an agent acting. Of a Beit Din law, but Beit Din themselves know, Kamash Malan, that Mishnah is also the rule for a Beit Din. That's why it's not set. It's as if they made a mistake in a Mishnah, because you could have misunderstood the Mishnah to be talking about a Shliach. Gemara's answer is no, it's also talking about a Beit Din. A Beit Din has to do a Achraz, has to do a public auction in order for it to be an irreversible transaction, is that they have to do it through real price discovery. All right. Etavei Rav Asher the Meimar. Shuma Dayanim. Shepichtu shtut, o tiru shtut, michran batel, which is our Mishnah. Hashaveh b'shaveh, if they did the proper amount, michran kayam, then their transaction goes through. My love, delo achruz. Our Mishnah must be talking about a case where they didn't do a public auction. Well, you see over there that they didn't do a public auction, and yet the transaction stands. So here, when they did it at the right price, and they did it without a public auction, we say that the transaction stands. So that's against what you just said here, that a lack of public auction is enough to reverse the transaction. It says, lo, bidachruz. Now, it's a case where they made it into a public auction. Hamid is safe about the achruz. Avereshah bidachruz. What do you mean? The rei safe of our mission talks about a geret bikoret. So the geret bikoret is exactly that. It's a public auction where they have real price discovery. So if that's the case of the safe, then the ratio must be in a case where it's not any geret bikoret. It's not a case of achrazah. And it says, Diktani Sefer, because the latter half of the mission says, Imasui Geret Bikoret, Avilu Machru, Shaveh Maneh B'Matayim, Shaveh Matayim Maneh, Michran Kayam. So you see in the latter half of the mission, it was a public auction. It's Elo Olam, Delo Achruz. So now it's a case where there was no public auction. Velo Kashas, how do we reconcile our Mishnah with the statement of Amemar, Mishmei de Rav Yosef, that you need a public auction in order for it to be a binding transaction? Kan B'Dvarim Shemachazim Alim, Kan B'Dvarim Shemachazim Alim. There are different buckets of items. Some items require a public auction. Other items do not require a public auction. So things that require a public auction, if you don't use a public auction, then you're in violation of a Mishnah. And if that's the case, it would be chuzer. We would reverse the transaction. In a case where there are objects that do not require a public auction, then if Beit Din gets the right price, then we're fine with it going through. You can't reverse the transaction with that. Ve'elu hein dvarim shein machrizin alehem. What are items which we do not do public auctions for? Havadim. We don't do public auctions for slaves. The reason being that they might run away. If they know that they're going to be put up on public auction, then they might try to run away because they know that there's some sort of unclear ownership here. And because of that, they feel that they have an opportunity to escape or to run away because nobody's really responsible for them in the meantime, and they know they're going on the auction block. Hametaltalim. We don't do it for non-real property. Because we're worried about theft. Because you have to put these out in public for people to see them and to look at them, because you're going to put them up to auction, then what? They could be swiped. Every day for 30 days, you're going to have people morning and night taking a look at these objects and coming by and looking at them. If you're not watching them carefully, somebody could walk off with them and swipe the object. So therefore, we don't do a public auction for that. Ve'ashtarot. And we don't do it for ishtar. Why you're selling a shtar over here is interesting. Why not just collect the shtar? Obviously, they're selling off the right of collection. So either it's because the time of collection hasn't come yet, and therefore they're selling it at a slight discount because they need the cash right now. Or it's a case where the party on the other side is either defaulting or is difficult to collect from. So it's like a bad debt collector buying off the bad debt over here. So they're selling off the bad debts in terms of the shtarot. And same with Abadim. Abadim over here is interesting because in general, we would only sell real property on behalf of Yitomim in order to pay for things. So why are we selling Abadim over here and not real property? Either it could be because of the fact that they have no real property and that's why they're selling the Abadim. Or it could be determined that that will raise the right amount of money that they need, or it'll be easier to monetize versus the karka. So because of that, they chose to sell Abadim instead of karka. And as Tosafot points out, that itlan uk mahalani metaltalin ushtarot ugon shiichdan la ktuba, that must be a case where these were directed collateral for her ktuba, or inami de tafsan mechayim, or that she actually grabbed them while her husband was still alive, because if not, these are not mishubad to the mizonot, and they're not mishubad to her ktuba. So only way we would be selling these possessions is if she's had some right to these possessions, and that can only be if they were directed collateral, or if she had taken possession of them while he was still alive. All right. Abadim, time of mine. So what's the reason behind the Abadim? Shema Yishmu Vibruchu. Because maybe they'll hear about it and they'll run away. Metaltalin Ushtarot. Shema Yishganvu. Because maybe they will be stolen. We're worried about them being swiped. Vibayitema. Kan Bishash Machrizim. Kan Bishashain Machrizim. It depends on when it is. It's not talking about objects that we do public auctions for and objects that we don't do public auctions for, but rather, there's certain times where we do sales without public auctions, and there's certain times where we do sales with public auctions, the basic distinction being the necessity or the time sensitivity of the sale. How fast do we need to monetize that? And that, Amrei Nardai, we saw again this earlier in the Masechta back on Pei Zayin, the cargo for the poll tax, limizone, for mizonot, ulekvurat amet, mezvinan below achrasta. We sell without any public auction. Because, first of all, kvura is obvious that we do this, because, but you're going to leave the mate lying around until you get this public auction done. That's completely unfathomable. So we sell quickly in order to bury the mate, or to raise monies for the proceeds to be used to bury the mate. That's clear that we do that with expediency, because we don't want the mate sitting around. Back there, we discussed whether it was the kvura of the tomim, or the kvura of the mate himself, but either way, we did it with expedience. The karga, over here, Rashi says, kesef, gugolet ha-yitomim, that's to pay the poll tax of the yitomim, whereas Tosafot, back on Pei Zayin, disagree with Rashi and says that it's to pay the poll tax of the almana, because that's like a derivative of mizonot, and therefore we're talking about the paying of the mizonot of the almana, and so for the poll tax is a part of that. Mizone, again over here, is either the mizonot of the almana or the mizonot of the yitomim. Either way, you don't want them waiting around to eat. What are you going to say? They're going to starve until you get the public auction through. So in all these cases where expediency and efficiency are of importance, there we don't go to a public auction. So that might be the difference. Our Mishnah is talking about a case where they needed to do it quickly versus the Mishnah in Arachin, which is a case where they have more time to deal with the issue. It depends on the location. Different regions had different practices with regards to public auctions. Some of them conducted public auctions. Some of them did not conduct public auctions. Nachman says that in Narda, they never did these public auctions. They thought that's because they were experts in assessments. And therefore, they didn't need to go to a public auction to get the price discovery. They could have individuals look at it and give them the assessment. Amalei Rav Yosef Bar Menume, the Dima Farshali Mine de Rav Nachman. So Rav Yosef Bar Menume pours cold water over that thesis that if they were such good assessors, but rather because, Mishum Dekarlo Bnei Achle Nixe Dachrasta. Because they used to call these people those that eat the possessions of the public auction. Basically, as Rashi describes over here, they looked at people who bought from these auctions as preying on the almanot and the yatomim. Generally in these auctions, the items went for a lower price because people knew that they were being sold under somewhat of duress and they were coming from yatomim and almanot. So generally they went for lower prices. So people who bought in these auctions, they were called disparaging names because it looked like they were preying on the almanot and yatomim. So if you did a public auction, you're actually going to get the reverse effect, which is that if you do it through public auction, you're going to actually garner lower prices because people are going to be reluctant to buy because they know that people who buy at these auctions, other people look at them in a negative light. So therefore, we do it in a private manner because that way it maintains the integrity of the sale without the other person being called something negative, and therefore they'll be willing to pay a higher price. So in a case where the auction actually leads to lower pricing, we're not going to go to auction. We're going to do it in a private manner to maintain the integrity of the price. I'm Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Mitaltalin shel yitomim, shamim otan u'mochrin otan la'alter. When it comes to the mitaltalin of the yitomim, we assess them. U'mochrin otan la'alter, and then we sell them right away. Chistavar avyime mochrin otan l'shivakin. We wait till the shuk, and we sell them in the shuk. So a question of whether we monetize them immediately, or do we wait for the market day in order to monetize them? Velo plige, and they don't argue. Hadimikarek shuka, hadimirachek shuka. It depends on when the shuk is. If the shuk is nearby. Now whether that talks about distance proximity, or is it talking about time proximity, either way, if it's close by or it's near, meaning timing wise, then we would wait around for it. If it's something that either is far away or it's going to take a lot of time before the next shuk, then we don't want to hold the stuff around until the time of the shuk. Rav Kana Abi Yode Shichra Derab Misharshia Bar Chilka Yatma. So Rav Kana was actually a guardian or custodian for the beer of Rav Misharshia Bar Chilka, who was a yatom. Shaya Ad Riglo. He waited until the regel to sell it. Amar Afrika of the Nafal Bay Itzatzta, even though it starts to spoil, by keeping it around that long, the beer starts to spoil. So normally if the beer spoils, you would garner a lower price. Mighty Zuza Harifa. You will get a better price at the regel. Because everybody needs beer at the regel, and there is generally a shortage of it, the demand is high. So therefore you will get a better price, despite the fact that it's lower quality. By the time you get to the regel, it pays to wait for the regel because you'll get a higher price because of the demand at that time. So he was willing to trade off quality to get a better price. But he wouldn't just wait for the regel if it wouldn't improve the situation. If he could sell it now and at the regel at the same price, he would sell it today. Ravina v'yodei chamra de Ravina zute yatma. So Ravina had in his hands the wine of Ravina Jr., who was a yatom, barachte, and was his nephew. So you have Ravina Jr., who was his nephew, which he was the guardian, the custodian for his property, for the wine. Havaladidei nami chamra. But Ravina himself also had wine. Havakamasikle the sichra. He was shipping it off to Sichra to sell it in Sichra, where he thought he would fetch a higher price. So he's about to put it on a boat to go out to Sichra to fetch a higher price for his wine out in Sichra. After the Kamei de Ravashi, I'm like, Ma'u, I'm Tuye Ba'adan. Can I put Ravina Jr.'s, my nephew's, wine on the boat with my wine? Why? Because there's a risk that the boat will sink and they'll lose all the wine on the way to Sichra. So here there's a risk being undertaken in order to fetch a higher price. I would do it with my own wine. Can I also do this for the wine of my nephew? I'm like, Zil, Lo'adif Mididach. He says, go ahead and do it. Why is it any better than yours? Meaning that if you're willing to do this and undertake this risk for your wine, why wouldn't you do the same for your nephew's wine? You're not undertaking undue risk to sell your wine. This is the normal course of business. If you're acting this way with your own wine, then certainly you can act that way with the wine of your nephew. And that is obviously qualified by the fact that it has to be a normal risk and that he can't fetch a very close price to that without undertaking that risk nearby. It's not simply just for the profits, but it means that he will be significantly benefited by shipping it out, and therefore it's worth undertaking the risk. So we're not going to just talk about a guy who takes risks all the time and doesn't mind the risks, and therefore we're going to force the Tomim to do the same. It's a case where this would be a normal business risk that was undertaken by a party. Then if he does it for himself, he can also do it on behalf of the Yatom. Hamimaenet, Hashnia, Va'ilonit. A woman who annuls a marriage, this is obviously Dormetic Tana, who got married midrabanan, and then she annuls the marriage. Hashniya is someone who is Shniyot Arayot, Arayot midrabanan, and they got married. Vailonit, or a woman who is found to not be able to bear children, Ein Lahen Ktuba. They do not get a Ktuba, for different reasons. The Mema'enet over here does not get a Ktuba, because she annulled the marriage. She was Oker the marriage from its start. The way that the annulment works is that we make it as if the Kiddushin was not a Kiddushin, and as if they were never married. So therefore, she doesn't get a Ktuba, because they were never married. Same thing with the Alonit. The Alonit is deemed to be a Mekach Ta'ut, and it's as if the Kiddushin never went through, because this woman was assumed to be a childbearing woman, and since she was found not to be, it's a Mekach Ta'ut, and it's as if the marriage was unwound retroactively, because it was a Mekach Ta'ut. In the case of Shnei Le'arayot, that's a Knaso Midr Rabbanan, a Knas from the Rabbanan, because you violated the word of the Rabbanan, and you got married, despite the fact that there was an Isser Shnei Le'arayot. So the Rabbanan imposed here that you lose your Ktubah, because you violated the words of the Rabbanan. Not only do you lose your Ktubah, but you also lose the Tnaei Ktubah. You also lose those things that are embedded in the Ktubah, which is Velo Peirot. You do not get peirot. So here is a machloket as to what lo peirot means. Because the woman herself doesn't get peirot. Peirot are the nichse molog of the woman. The husband is entitled to the peirot. So the way the Rashi explains this in Yevamot is that pirkona, to redeem her. The Ketubah says that in exchange for the peirot, her husband redeems her, she's taken into captivity. So Rashi says over there, she loses the din of pirkona because he can't return her as a wife. I will redeem her to return her to me as a wife. Over here, he can't return her as a wife. Therefore, pirkona does not apply to him. And that's what it means. Not the peirot themselves, but rather what's quid pro quo for the peirot is what she doesn't get over here. Tosafot and Yevamot, and over here, Rashi does bring a daya like this, which is the peirot, meaning if he ate peirot, she's not entitled to get repaid for them. Even though now the marriage has been dissolved, nevertheless, the peirot that he ate, too bad, she doesn't get repaid for those, she doesn't get reimbursed for the peirot she lost. Velo mizonot. Again, here, she's not entitled to mizonot, not only post the death of her husband, but even whether her husband is alive, she's not entitled to mizonot. The Gemara will discuss what exactly the scenario is with the mema'enet, and why over here, what does it mean she's not entitled to mizonot? By the time she annulled, okay, but before that, she was a full-fledged wife, why isn't she getting mizonot? Velo bla'ot. And not worn down clothing. Now again, bla'ot is the nechasim of the woman that she brought into the marriage, which the husband is entitled to use. For instance, she brought in a cloak to the marriage that he wears. He's allowed to wear it normally, and the bla'ot, the remainder, the residual of that, is given to the woman. So again, here you can interpret it one of two ways. Either lo bla'ot, she doesn't get the residual that's left over. If the husband used it and there's a residual, she doesn't get it. Or lo bla'ot means the amount that the beged wore down, she's not entitled to reimbursement from the husband. Even though, again, the marriage is annulled, we're taking apart the marriage, nevertheless, despite the fact that now he shouldn't have been entitled to wearing this object and to depreciating the object, since he did it, we're not going to force him to reimburse the woman. So what you notice over here, what you pointed out, which is true, is all these penalties are on the woman, not on the man. Why are we penalizing the woman? Now, in the case of Mema'enet, where she was the instigator of the annulment, makes sense. She's the one who's annulling the marriage, therefore she loses the rights. But the case of Ailonit, which is a Mekach Ta'ot, because of her, there again we understand it. By Shnei Le'arayot, that's the question. By Shnei Le'arayot, they're both guilty here. Why is she being penalized? We'll discuss that in one second. Imitchila nasa l'shem Ailonit yesh la Ktuba. If he knew up front that she was an Ailonit, then there's no question over here. He can't claim Mekach Ta'ot because he knew about it up front, and therefore she's entitled to a Ktuba. Almana l'kohen gadol. All of these are restricted marriages. They are marriages that take hold where the kedushin are tofsin because they're only isurei lav or isurei aseh. So therefore, a widow to a kohen gadol, grusha v'chalutza l'kohen hedjot. All of these are illegal marriages. Mamzer v'netinah l'Israel, bat Israel l'natin mamzer. Whether it's a mamzeret or a netinah to a male Israel or a female Israel. To a natin or mamzer, all of these are isurim, yesh lehen ktuba. All of them have a ktuba. So now here the question becomes more pronounced. How come over here, where you have these illegal marriages, the woman's entitled to the ktuba? And in the case before, by the Shnei Le'arayot, the woman is not entitled to the ketubah. So basically, you're penalizing the woman in the first case, and you're penalizing the man in the second case, because here you have an illegal marriage, and we're forcing him to pay a ketubah anyway, even though he's not going to keep the woman in the end. So the difference being, Gemara in Yevamot spells this out, one difference, one layer of difference is, they'll write the Derabbanan. In the case of Shniel D'Arayot, it's Derabbanan, and therefore the Rabbanan require reinforcement. So that's why we cause the loss of Ketubah. Over here we're talking about Dinim Deoraita, so therefore you don't need reinforcement, so we're not going to change anything, no penalties over here, in order to force the dissolution of the marriage. On the other hand, the sharper distinction that's brought by the Gemara in Vamot is that the difference is who has a disincentive to be in the marriage over here. By the case of the Almanah, the Kohen Gadol, and all the list over there, the woman is Nifsala by the marriage. And her children are psulim because of the marriage. Therefore, the woman needs no disincentive to be in this marriage because she becomes a psula, her children will be psulim, she has a natural disincentive from being in the marriage. Therefore, who's the coaxing party over here? Who's the one who is trying to maintain the marriage? It must be the husband's side. Therefore, the husband is penalized in that case for having to pay out the ketubah because he's definitely the party that has the least to lose over here. And therefore, he's likely the party that is driving force behind this marriage. On the other hand, by the case of Shniot L'Arayot, where the woman is not psula, and her children are not psulin, over there we assume that it's the woman who is the instigator of the marriage, because over there she has no disincentive to be in the marriage, and a woman wants to be married, and therefore we assume that it's the woman who is pushing this marriage despite the Yisur, and that's why we penalize the woman by the Shniot L'Arayot. Right now, Gemara says, Rav Tani, Tana, Yotza Beget, Ein La Ketubah, V'choshekein Mima'enet. Rav says, and similarly Rav is qualifying our Mishnah, the Mishnah that talks about a Tana, who's dissolving a marriage, if she dissolves it through a get, she doesn't get a Ketubah. If she dissolves it through Mion, by annulling the marriage, she also doesn't get a Ketubah. Shmuel Tani, Mima'enet, Ein La Ketubah. And then Shmuel is medayik from the Mishnah, which is that a mimanet, one who annuls the marriage, doesn't get a ketubah. Ava yotza beget, yesh la ketubah. But if she does it through a bill of divorce, she will be entitled to a ketubah. Ve'azda Shmuel letameh. And Shmuel is l'shitato. Damar Shmuel, mimanet, ein la ketubah. That a woman who annuls a marriage is not entitled to a ketubah. Yotza beget, yesh la ketubah. But on the other hand, if she divorces, then she is entitled to a ketubah. Mimanet, lo pasla min achim, v'lo pasla min akuna. And similarly, when she annuls the marriage, she is allowed to marry his relatives, and he's allowed to marry her relatives, because it's as if the marriage never existed, and she's considered to be a ketana mifuta, or basically a ketana anusa. V'lo pasla min akuna. And there was nothing illicit about this marriage, and therefore, she can marry a kohen. Yotza beget. And since there was no divorce over here, she can marry a kohen. Yotza beget. On the other hand, when they use a bill of divorce to dissolve the marriage, pasla min achim, upasla min akuna. She can't marry a kohen now because she's deemed to be a divorcee, even though it's only a divorcee, the Rabbanan. And also pasla min achim, she may not marry his relatives, he may not marry her relatives, because now you have a get, which makes it look like they had a full-fledged marriage, and therefore we're not going to allow you to get married to the arayot, or krovim, quote-unquote. Mimanet, ina tzrecha lamtim shlosha chodoshim. And mimanet doesn't have to wait 3 months until she remarries. Now it's obvious here that she's not pregnant, so you won't have to wait the 3 months to determine in terms of pregnancy, because she's a ktana. So she's clearly not pregnant. Nevertheless, normally we say that the chamim made no differentiation, and every woman has to wait 3 months, whether there's a chashash she's pregnant or not. Nevertheless, over here Shmuel says, if it's done through Mion, she doesn't have to wait the 3 months. Yotza beget, tzricha lamtin shlosha chodoshim. On the other hand, if it's through a bill of divorce, she has to wait the 3 months, even though again, she's no possibility of being pregnant, because it looks like a real marriage. My kamash malan. What is Shmuel teaching us over here? Tanina kulu. All of these are mentioned in a Mishnah. Hamemanet beish. Hu mutar bekrovotah, v'hi muteret bekrovav. V'lo pasla min akuna. A woman who annuls a marriage, a ketana who annuls a marriage, they are allowed to marry each other's relatives, and there is no restriction against marrying a kohen. Natan la get. On the other hand, if there was a bill of divorce used, Asur b'krov v'av, yasur b'krov v'av, upaslam min akuna. So all the regular dinim of a divorced couple will apply. She will not be able to marry a kohen. They will both be restricted in each other's relatives. So the Gemara answers, tzricha lamtim gimel chodashim mitzricha le'ei, t'lo tznan. But now we need a small statement to teach us what's not mentioned in the Mishnah, and that is the waiting the 3 months. That is the difference between a memanet and a get, which is a memanet does not have to wait the requisite 3 months between this marriage and the next marriage, because in essence, the first marriage wasn't a marriage because she annulled it. Whereas in the case of get, she will have to wait the requisite 3 months. Even though there's no chance she's pregnant, it still will fall under the takanat chachamim that women have to wait 3 months after the first marriage, before the second marriage, in order to distinguish between children born to the first husband and children born to the second husband, even though it may not be relevant in this instance. So Shmuel added on that additional aspect that wasn't found in the Mishnah. And again, that's Shmuel the Tameh, where he draws a distinction that our Mishnah is only by Mima Enet, and not by a case of Get, because by a case of Get, she would be entitled to a Ketubah. Unlike Rav, who says that she's not entitled to a Ketubah, not when it was done through Mion, not when it was done through a get. Tomorrow we'll continue 7 lines down on the top of Kuf Aleph Aleph to understand this machloka between Rav and Shmuel.